Now, BFBS brings you a unique insight into the life journey of some of the residents of the Royal Hospital Chelsea as they reminisce on this, their final posting. Chelsea Pensioners, a life served.
BFBS. The moment I walked through the gates, I knew this is where I needed to be.
Unfortunately, he'd been one of the people that had gone to Bethlehem. He said it was the most horrific 3 or 4 weeks of his life, and it took him a long time to get over it.
Well, it was really while it lasted. I've got now, I'd rather have a cup of tea.
My greatest companion and greatest supporter was Patricia.
And then one day the doctor said, get her back to England. I then started to tout people for a kidney. I found a donor, which was the most amazing because it turned out to be me.
I heard the shot and I hit the ground. The chap was firing at me. I knew that he was firing at me.
They were throwing rocks at him. Well, unfortunately, one of the rocks wasn't a rock, it was a bomb. And Johnny Rutledge was killed there.
We're still fighting them. I seem to have been fighting them ever since I joined the army. I've never found out who they are, but we're still fighting them.
We're probably going to be in for a bit of trouble here.
I know I'm not going to get many more postings. Let's put it that way.
The story of the Royal Hospital Chelsea began more than 300 years ago during the reign of King Charles II. The home was built as a refuge and shelter for army veterans and sits in 66 acres of prime real estate in Chelsea, southwest London. Built by Sir Christopher Wren and finished in the spring of 1692. Since then, thousands of retired soldiers have surrendered their army pension to call it home. Today, we're going to meet four residents and discover who these people once were and who they are now.
My name is Gordon Leslie Sanders, better known as Sandy. I was born in 1936. My father was a sergeant in the South Staffordshire Regiment, and I was born in India. I'm one of the last of a dying breed, a barrack rat.
My name's Dennis Shields, Dennis Joseph Shields. I was born in Lancashire in 1927.
Well, my name is Edward James Roberts. I was a corporal in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. I did 22 and a half years, and I'm now residing in the Royal Hospital Chelsea.
My name is Brian Allen Cumming. I was born in Plymouth in 1932, so I'm now 82 years of age, and I've been here now in the Royal Hospital Chelsea since, for 4 years.
Before donning the iconic scarlet tunic and black tricorn hat, all of the residents of Chelsea had to enlist.
When I signed up, I was 15 when I joined. I joined up because my father was a soldier, my grandfather was a soldier, I had three uncles that were a soldier and a great uncle that was a soldier. So I think there was no option really. I think they just pointed out which thing I should go into, and I joined it. I joined the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers because all of my family had been in the South Staffordshire Regiment, and they wanted me to have a profession when I left the army. So I went to Arborfield, which is the Army Apprentices College, and I became what they called a telecommunications mechanic, which I continued as until I came out in 1976 as an artificer ASM, which is about as high as I could get as a non-commissioned officer.
Not everyone inside the hospital initially joined the army. Despite serving with them later, Dennis began his military career with the Marines.
I'd heard stories from my father. He had five brothers, and three of them were killed in World War I, all in France. And the stories about those, some of them were, two of them were decorated, and all of them had only good to say about the service. And I had to wait until I was 16, and that was 43. And the scheme, it was RNYE, Royal Navy Youth Entry. That was for Royal Marines, Fleet Air Arm and Seamen.
It started off, I was supposed to go to work on a Saturday morning, and I didn't. I went to Blackheath and signed on. And when I got home, my dad said, "You're home a bit early." I said, "I didn't go to work. I've been down and signed on." And when the language had calmed down and everything, he pat me on the back. He said, "Good lad." My mum was up for it because she knew, because of cadets, and my brother Alf was in. And actually, he's a pensioner here now, my brother. She was all for it. I signed up because life, jobs weren't all that good in Civvy Street. The pay was £2.10 a week. And my brother was in the army. My dad was in the, had been in the army. So I thought that was a better life.
I signed up to follow my grandfather. My grandfather was in the 2nd Battalion, the Border Regiment. And although my father was in the Naval Reserve, I decided I wanted to be a soldier rather than a sailor. Basic training was hard, well, it was expected to be hard, but good fun. Although I do remember having upset the Sergeant Major, being told to weed the bottom end of the parade ground with a knife. And so if you stepped out of line, you expected to be kicked. But it was good. You learned what life was all about at 17 and a half, and you came out the other end a man.
Sandy, Dennis, Ted and Brian are all widowed, but the memories of their sweethearts remain.
My first love was at school. She told me she was called Genevieve Reynard. I found out she was called Winnie Fox.
My first love was a deaf and dumb girl. Her name was Pat Cooksley, and she won a beauty contest for Camberwell. And then I joined the army, and her dad said to her, "Stop it, don't go out of him no more, because you'll never see him." And that was it. And, well, to tell the truth, my dad went down to him and put one on him for splitting us up, because we'd been together for 4 years before I joined. She was absolutely gorgeous. Long black hair, fringe. Yeah, she was absolutely... Well, she won a beauty contest. So she had to look like something. I loved her that much, I've got her name tattooed on my arm. My first date, and you'll laugh at this, I took her to the cinema. Her being deaf and dumb... this is gospel truth. And we was watching the film, and I said to her, not thinking, "Do you want an ice cream?" And she looked at me and just waved her arms, because the cinema was in darkness. And I made a right fool of myself, actually. She explained afterwards that she has to look at me to understand me and what I was saying. That was my first proper date.
I can only just remember my first love, really, when I started to courting, as it was called then. It was very formal then. And she was a young girl at a teacher's training college. And she was 17 and a half, which was much older than me. But she was posted rather than I. Before I left there, she'd already gone to another school somewhere. Well, it was thrilling while it lasted. You know, but I've got now, I'd rather have a cup of tea.
It was most romantic. We went to the drill hall dance in the drill centre, the all-arms training centre in Wokingham. Most romantic, it really was, yeah. Went out and had a half a beer in the local pub, which was exciting for her because she was underage, and so it went on. We went visiting all her aunts and uncles and that sort of thing. She sat one end of the settee and I sat the other. It was a typical old-fashioned courtship. Especially, of course, everybody is looking down over their glasses because I'm in the army. I mean, it was like... Well, at least it was slightly better than the fact that I could have been to prison, you know.
When it came to actually taking Phyllis out on a date, for instance, once I had the old man's approval, it was all right. And We didn't venture very far from home in those days. We went on a tram ride or a bus ride into Manchester. We picked some of the little pubs around there. We weren't much in the way of drinking, or Phyllis wasn't, I had my share. But she was very easily pleased, Phyllis. That's why my marriage lasted 57 years. I suppose that the two best things that I've done in my life, and really, it was proposing to Phyllis and being accepted, and the other one is coming here. This place, I can't think anyone could really complain about anything.
My wife Doreen, I met her when I was stationed at CAD Kyneton, which is an ammunition dump. She was the ambulance driver. At the time, I was going out with another two women. But Doreen won my vote, because she was a good girl, and we got married, and we had two children. Well, we had three, but one of them buried in Germany. Jennifer, her name was. And then everything was wonderful. We was married for 47 years. And she died in 2008 with lung cancer. And since then, I've been in here, come to Royal Hospital, because I couldn't cope on my own.
It wasn't until I left school at the age of 14 and started work in the Plymouth Cooperative Society building as a furniture salesman that I met my first real girlfriend, and who subsequently became my wife. That was the age of 15. Her name was Patricia Sheila Joan Dodd, and she looked great. She was terrific. We were married for 58 years, and we were together most of that time, except for the first 3 years when I was in Egypt. And because we were underage, as far as the regiment was concerned, you had to be at least 20. Well, you had to be 21 to be on the strength of the regiment married. And she remains my greatest companion and greatest supporter was Patricia, all the way through our marriage. And it was 5 years ago I lost her, and it was a great blow.
My first love was my mother. But I was literally a one-woman man. I met a girl in Arborfield in 1955. Her name was Patricia. Patricia, yeah. She's a lovely lady. And I married her in 1960, and we were together till she died in 2007. So I think we got the 47 and 48 years in, but we never made the 50, unfortunately. She had an incurable illness, which led to me literally retiring and going and living in Portugal for 16 years, because it was better for her there. She had what they call polycystic kidneys, which eventually killed her. But what in actual fact happened is the doctor said it would be better if I took her to a place where it was much drier. So we picked on Portugal, and we went and lived in the Algarve for 16 years. And then one day the doctor said, get her back to England, which I had to do straight away. Having got her back, I then started to tout people for a kidney, because she needed a donor, because both of them were dying. And I found a donor, which was the most amazing, because it turned out to be me. And it was the first case of a non-related person being able to give their wife a kidney, which is, I was very proud of.
You often hear about the camaraderie in the forces and about the lifelong friendships that get forged. But in the army, that can depend on who you sign up with.
Within the army, the friendships you make are made for life. I mean, I received an email from a fella called Mick Fone, now lives in Spain. I hadn't seen him since we spent 4 days in a safety house in Iran during the revolution in 78. I just literally sent a long email to him while we'd been trying to work out where we'd both been and how we'd missed each other for the last 40 years.
Unless you are in the infantry and then in a battalion, you join as a private and you're in a family environment. With me being in the Corps, you were posted as an individual. So you never really made any friends. You made a lot of acquaintances. For 3 years, you became friendly with Fred, George, whoever it is. But then the 3 years were up, you moved off and made some more acquaintances. It wasn't until you actually left the service that you started to make friends, that you could call friends.
On occasionally, when things did get tough, we had our own means of getting away with it, and usually that employed a few jars of whatever ale was there to start with. It didn't remain with us for very long, because you didn't know about the following day what was going to happen. I was lucky on one occasion. There was a sergeant called Johnny Rutledge, and it was my turn to go with the first troop out. He wanted to go on it instead of me, and I'd do his duty later. And that's what happened. He went on it, but the students were senior students. They were all 18 or so. They were throwing rocks at them from the top of one of the buildings, flat-top buildings. Well, unfortunately, one of the rocks wasn't a rock. It was a bomb, a homemade grenade. And Johnny Rutledge was killed there. And that was... It was a mixed feeling then, because I liked Johnny Rutledge. Everybody liked Johnny Rutledge. It should have been me, not him.
Taking the mickey out of each other is part of military life. One which really springs to mind is to have looked at a chap in his bed, seeing he was dead fast asleep, picked him up in his bed and taken him out and set him in the middle of the regimental square and left him there, was one of the jokes we constantly played on each other. The other time I recall, there was in the MT section, we looked under a vehicle and there was a chap laid there, and he was obviously asleep, but what he'd done, in fact, he was undoing a nut or something, because he had a monkey wrench in his hand, and he'd tied his wrist to it so it looked as though he was actually working. But a quick glance underneath, oh yeah, he's working all right. But he was fast asleep. So those sort of things you got up to, yeah, sure.
I'd do it again tomorrow. Every day of it, even in the snow, the rain, cold in Germany, Saltar Ranges, I'd do it all again. I think it's fantastic, and every man should do it.
All four men were too young to have fought in World War II, but each retains a vivid memory of the conflict.
When the war started, I found out on a tram in Manchester, and I was on the way to school, and somebody came on the tram and said that they just heard that the war had started, and it came round to most of the boys got off the tram and got, that was an excuse to get back home. We were so young, we were elated. You know, some of us were already cadets, you know. And it's exciting. All my friends, most of whom were a little bit older than I was, were going in, and I thought, not leaving me out.
The way I heard about the outbreak of war in 39 was, we were living in a little village called Lee Mill, which is in the south of Devon. And there was my mother and father and my sister and I. And we knew, or father had told us, there is something going to be said on the radio tonight, so we must listen. And we sat in the kitchen in front of the radio.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing.
And we heard this voice saying that because of the problems in Germany, we are now at war. Of course, we didn't understand what that really meant. And so father had to explain what it meant. And so, you know, we're probably going to be in for a bit of trouble here. And we were, because our house was bombed within the next month, I suppose.
This country is at war with Germany.
Thank you.
has provided some problems that have worried us all quite a lot. Where can poor Pa go in the blackout? Where can poor Pa go at nights? He can't find his way to his favourite club. He can't find his pals because he can't find the pub. So where does poor Pa go in the blackout?
We'd had a building built onto the side of an existing house, and that was an air raid shelter. Our dad had done a damn good job inside. When the bombers came over, he'd run out. There was a wooden door. There was a homemade wooden door on it. And he'd run outside and shout, "Buggers are here again." And the mothers give him a rollicking then for swearing.
Well, we had our Anderson shelter in the garden, which Father dug and put in, so we knew that. But my sister and I used to use that as a play area. We had candles down there, and we would light the candles and melt them, and then make little small candles until we were caught. And then one early morning when there was a raid, and we were down in the shelter, and the bomb hit our house, so we had to move. And we went off to live in this little village, and we spent the rest of the war in this village. But that didn't stop us from feeling the effects of the war, because I distinctly remember a group of us children coming across one of the open fields, and it was a daylight raid, and a German aircraft came out of Plymouth across the area where we were, and they obviously didn't realise that we were children, I suppose, but they let rip a load of attack on people on that field, and it was us. Fortunately, none of us were hurt, but yeah, that's what I remember. And the sound of the sirens started very slowly and then grew up to a great crescendo. That was the warning sign. It constantly up and down until it finally disappeared into the unknown somewhere. The moment you heard it, no matter where you were, you knew you had to get under cover. And I think that was the first thought, as I remember. I didn't feel frightened, I don't think. I felt, oh, that siren has started. Right, I know, I've got to get undercover now. And I think that was the only thought I had in my mind. I didn't think I felt frightened at all. If you were near home, for instance, so you could make a quick dash to the Anderson air raid shelter, or to get undercover. But if you were out on the, as we were on the field that particular day, there was nowhere you could go. You just had to hope that you weren't going to be the target.
What I really remember as the end of the war was the King's speech being putting on, and the whole school reporting to listen to it in the main hall. And that's when we realised we really had got peace. Having got rid of, got used to that, for the first 2 months it was a succession of parties, and there was a real feel-good atmosphere about everything. And then life gradually went back to normal, and then this strange man came to live with us, who I suddenly found out was my father, who I hadn't seen for years. It was a time of a lot of change, and a time for people haven't really, like my mother and father, really getting to know themselves again, and for me to get to know him, you know. He came back very, 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 very tired, because unfortunately, he'd been one of the people that had gone to Belsen, which of course I didn't understand at the time, but of course I do understand now how he felt. I did have the chance to speak to him about it, and also I made a point of, when I was in Germany, going to Belsen to see what he'd told me about. He said it was the most horrific 3 or 4 weeks of his life, and it took him a long time to get over it.
Anyone over 65 who was a regular soldier in the British Army, and that includes officers who have served for a minimum of 12 years in the ranks, can apply to become a Chelsea pensioner. And it was in March 2009 that the hospital first admitted women. Before joining, Sandy, Dennis, Ted and Brian had all struggled to cope with life on their own after their wives died.
You'll never know just how much I miss you. You'll never know just how much I care.
After the wife died, I sort of hit the bottle for a year and a half. And then my children said to me, "Dad, how about sorting yourself out and going into Chelsea Pensioners?" So my son went through his computer, got the paperwork, I filled it in, and I got accepted after, because I think you wait about 6 months before you get accepted, they check on you. And I got accepted, and I thank my children very much. I don't think I'd have been alive today.
The moment you put on the scarlets, you must realise that you are representing hundreds of years of service to the Crown and Constitution. And you must act. You must act in that capacity, in that way. If you should fall out of line, then you're not only letting yourself down, you're letting the hospital down, your regiment down, and your family down. So the moment you become a Chelsea pensioner, you are somebody different. You really are a different person. And you should remember that and act accordingly.
Civilians don't understand the banter. If we say to civilians what we say to each other, we'd be in jail. But it's the banter's always there, and it's fantastic.
We're still fighting them. I seem to have been fighting them ever since I joined the army. I've never found out who they are, but we're still fighting them.
The children want you home to end your days. My family want me to end my days here. And the woman I'm with wants me to end my days with her. But I'm determined to end my days here, and I'm very happy to, because it's a wonderful place for your last posting.
Once you come here, you're going to be in the, I know I'm not going to get many more postings, let's put it that way.
Some years ago, my late wife, my wife and I were talking about what would happen if we didn't go together. I knew that I'd made provision for her if I went. She would be looked after with a Masonic home. But I was undecided about what would happen if she went. So I thought about it for a while, then I thought, I'll have a go at this Chelsea pensioner business. And I never thought any more about it. 5 years ago, I lost it to cancer. I stayed at home for a year. And then I thought, well, this is no good. Pat's been with me all this time. We've travelled the world together. We've been everywhere. I can't sit here and just vegetate or wait to die. I'm going to have a go at this Chelsea business. So I rang up and got the application forms. So I filled them in, sent them off, and was duly asked to come up and spend the 4 days here as a four-day man. Quite honestly, I can tell you, the moment I walked through the gates, I knew this is where I needed to be. It was that feeling, that instant feeling. I knew that I needed to be here, and I'm happy that I'm going to be here, God willing, until that final parade.
Thank you to the Royal Hospital Chelsea and the pensioners for sharing their stories. Gordon Leslie Sanders, Dennis Shields, Ted James Roberts, and Brian Alan Cunning. Chelsea Pensioners, a life served. This has been a Richard Hatch and Hal Stewart production for BFBS.
I like to keep smart. Don't like long hair, don't like beards. Richard is someone that frightens me. Because I wouldn't like to look like, no disrespect, but it's too much.
No one wants to look like this.
On digital.
digital radio, FM and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air around the world.
This is the Forces Station.
The FBS.